Welcome. The boys are back in town. Jonathan and Matt have returned from their World Cup adventures in Russia, and just in time because we have a lot to talk about. Joachim Löw has decided to stay on as Germany's national team coach after their exit from the group stage. Can he lead his country back to prosperity? And what is German football going to look like by Euro 2020? This is the World Cup from the Tribune. Dejus van Opdorp here with Jonathan Harding and Matt Ford. We're all back in the studio. Jonathan came back from Russia after covering the German national team. Matt came back from Kaliningrad after watching England beat Belgium.
Lose to Belgium.
I'm so caught up with what they did last night. I thought that they've been winning. They've been winning basically this entire World Cup. But they came back at the perfect time because Joachim Löw yesterday announced that, well, the German national team announced yesterday that Löw is going to stay on as the German national team coach. Now, of course, this comes after their disappointing exit from the group stage. And it was, to me, it was kind of like, even just the way that they broke the news was kind of strange because, I mean, Löw said afterwards that after the game against South Korea, that he didn't know what the future would hold for him. He was going to make a decision the next week. And then you heard Reinhard Grindel and Oliver Bierhoff basically stand up for Löw afterwards. A lot of people in German media, a lot of German pundits, and a lot of people that I've seen on Twitter also have all called for Löw to leave. And yet, perhaps they needed to announce that he's going to stay and fulfill his contract because that was maybe the unpopular choice to make. Jonathan, you were obviously around the Germany camp a lot in Russia. What did you make of the Löw decision? Were you surprised at all?
Not really. I think Matt wrote about it yesterday, and we've talked about it before, and the truth of the matter is the DFB didn't leave themselves any option. I think Joachim Löw is still a very good coach. I think it's very easy to forget what he has done for German football. But the way that the collective, Germany, the DFB and Löw and his staff have handled the last 6 months has been surprisingly poor. And I think the clearest indication that this was going to go wrong came from the players and from Löw himself when they admitted that they thought that they could just turn it on when this tournament started. And I think that in itself is an admission of complacency. If you track it back even further, the fact that after 2014, the DFB hadn't really made plans to find a successor for Löw suggests a certain level of overconfidence to me. There is no level of sustained success at international sport on any level beyond, I don't know, 4 years is an incredibly long time. It's very, very difficult to have a long, long reign of success. Even for a team like the All Blacks, for example, who have the winningest record in the history of all sports teams.
Even Spain.
It's very, very difficult to sustain that at the top. So you have to prepare for it. And on a number of levels, Germany don't seem to have done that. And there are a number of reasons why. But the number one indication of that seems to be that they never thought about what would happen after Löw. Even in 2015 or 16. There was never a plan for after Löw. And I think that is a problem. Because now they have to stick with him, you know, unnecessarily extending his contract before the tournament. Another sign of overconfidence, perhaps. Why? There's no need. You know, let it run its course. Yeah. But they don't have a backup plan. So am I surprised? No. Am I disappointed? Yes.
Matt, that move in and of itself, the contract extension before the World Cup was strange just because his contract was going through the next European Championship anyways. So one of my favorite lines that you wrote in your commentary was that Löw had all the cards and there was no reason for him to bow out now. Why do you think that the DFB gave Löw so much power going into this World Cup?
The simple answer is that I really don't know. And like I wrote in the piece, I did think it was a very, very strange decision at the time. There really was no reason to announce that, 7 weeks or 5 weeks before the start of the tournament. unless, I mean, I can only speculate and think, was it almost a psychological ploy because they themselves recognised that perhaps the preparations weren't up to scratch, the mentality wasn't quite there, something was a little bit amiss, so perhaps giving this contract boost, although it wasn't really necessary, would somehow give an extra mental, psychological push to the players that, yeah, this is pure confidence and trust in Lerv, that we know what he's doing, that will give them a push. Perhaps that was a factor. Perhaps there were financial considerations that John and me and you were talking about yesterday, that should they want to get rid of him, maybe they wanted more security because the DFB simply don't have the money to find a replacement at the moment. We talked about the I think 19.2 million euros in tax they have to pay back after the revelations in the wake of the 2006 World Cup awarding. There's also a 150 million euro DFB training centre in Frankfurt, which they've committed funds to. So I think there are potentially financial factors there, which have backed the German FA into a corner. And so, yeah, the whole decision really did surprise me. And like I said, it's taken whatever cards did remain in the German FA's hands post-tournament for the eventuality that there was a disaster. They now hold none of them. Joachim Löw has come out of this tournament, despite the fiasco, in a huge position of strength. There are no suitable candidates to replace Löw at the moment. I've heard a couple of German fans mention Stefan Kuntz, who obviously did well with the under-21s, I think, under-21s. Otherwise, Jurgen Klopp, no, that's not going to happen. Christian Streich,
that's more of a pipe dream.
Yeah, I mean, there really is no suitable option. He's also received backing from within the dressing room, from both sides of the split in the dressing room. And I think, John, you've confirmed that some of the stuff that you heard in Russia, that there was a split, that has taken place between the Confederations Cup winners of 2017 and the 2014 World Cup winners. Obviously, I think a lot of that probably stems from the fact that a lot of those younger players thought that they should then be should have been given the chance to move on and blood this new generation. Lerv, of course, in the end, trusted his old guard, which I think, looking back, we can probably say that was a mistake and has probably set Germany back a couple of years at least. But yeah, players from both sides of that divide have come out and supported him. I think Kimmich has supported him, Marco Reus. And on the other end, we've also had, I think, Mats Hummels, Toni Kroos have come out in support. So the support is there from the players. And as John said, I don't think Joachim Löw is also a bad coach. I think he's also, I mean, the fiasco here aside, in which obvious mistakes were made, and we might get into that in a second, it doesn't change the fact that he is still a very good coach. He proved in 2017 with that Confed Cup win that he is still capable of gelling a new young side and building these players into a credible and competent unit which can win competitions. And that goes against the argument that maybe he's become a little bit aloof. And I think that's an understandable argument to have as well.
Yeah, I mentioned this the last time we did a podcast, that there were some surprising comments that I said that Löw didn't have a connection with the younger generation, which is why he may not be the right man for the job. John, I don't agree with that at all. Did you see anything in Russia that showed that he couldn't communicate with his players anymore?
Or? I mean, it's difficult. In Russia, the experience that you have covering the German national team is that you're allowed 15 minutes to watch the team, and then they close off training. And those 15 minutes are sometimes a bit of a joke because the players...
15 minutes to watch the warm-up.
Yeah, not just that, but they might spend 8 minutes of that 15 in the tent. And the DFB doesn't care. They don't care that those 15 minutes have now... half of that has been lost because they've been doing exercises in the tent. Now, this isn't a question about the suitability of those exercises. I'm not in a position to question the coaching. That's not what we're talking about here. But it does expand into part of the wider context of this conversation. The DFB completely shut themselves off, and in doing so, they lost touch with reality. There was nothing real about this team. You know, to get anywhere, you had to walk through hashtags and billboards and advertising, and then you were 55 meters away from someone doing a leg stretch
in a tent.
Yeah, and there's nothing real about that. Now, this isn't about media access. This is just about a team that seems to have removed itself so far from the reality that they have lost touch with what maybe makes sense for them. I don't think Löw had, so it's difficult for me to give you 100% answer to the question about whether Löw has really lost connection with his younger players. From what I feel and what I saw from that Germany team, I don't think that was the case. I think that there are a number of factors at play here. Individual issues, Mesut Ozil, Ilkay Gundogan, that Erdogan issue has obviously affected them mentally. I don't think Ilkay Gundogan recovered from that at all. And Mesut Ozil has been the scapegoat of the German national team for years. And in the last few months, that's probably hit him harder than ever before. And mentally, we shouldn't underestimate what that's done to those two. I mean, if you think about the fact that Gundogan was crying in the changing rooms after the Saudi Arabia game in Leverkusen and he needed picking up, I don't think he recovered. And you watch the way that he played in his fleeting appearances, suggests to me that he wasn't in the right frame of mind. So you have that situation. You probably have a reaction from other players to that political event anyway. And how do you handle that in the changing room? That's one thing. You have the Confederations Cup players who feel that they're ready to deliver and not just be on the bench. And then you've got the old guard who obviously have a great standing with Löw, who perhaps in some respects took their positions for granted and just thought that they could deliver because they were on the pitch. That didn't work at all. And that was then seen through communication errors because there were clear divisions in this team based on the lack of communication. You look at the Mexico game and you look at the South Korea game. There is no way that a backline communicates that poorly with their midfield if there's a better understanding. Sami Khedira now looks like a midfielder who can't play at the international level, but he's obviously an important player for the changing rooms. Is that still the case in light of all of these issues? I don't know. You've got an experienced striker like Mario Gomez who offers something completely different but never really did what he was there to do. He was supposed to score goals. He had good chances to do that. He didn't do it. Timo Werner was effective on the left. He wasn't effective up front. So you've also got the tactical issues that players were playing better in some positions and not well in others, and that there were lack of communication or even understanding about how to implement their game style. All of those things combined mean that Joachim Löw has struggled to get this team playing as a team. I don't think it's just the disconnect with younger players. I think it's a huge combination of factors. And quite frankly, I think any team would have struggled under all of those circumstances. And let's not forget, this is a team coming in as the defending champions, not one of the favourites. And the mentality in that is completely different to 4 years ago. So it's a lot of issues combined. Nevertheless, I cannot get away from Germany's arrogance. We thought we would just turn it on when the tournament started. Thomas Müller said that, admitted that that was a mistake a couple days before the Sweden game. Mats Hummels said after the South Korea game, we haven't played a good game since March 2017. Mats Hummels said after the Saudi Arabia game that that was a wake-up call too late. Joachim Löw said at some point, I can't remember now, we obviously thought that we could just turn it on. Every single one of those comments is related to the same thing. We assumed. We presumed we could play the same football. And that, for me, is a fundamental flaw of, if you want to be one of the great sides, you cannot make any assumptions about the way that you played 4 years ago or 2 years ago. Because let's be honest, the way they played against France in the semifinals was pretty good at the Euros. They were just pretty poor up front, but they were still good. You cannot assume that that's enough. And look at all the other teams in this tournament that have come forward, stepped forward and stepped up to the same level that Germany were playing 4 years ago. That's what I think annoys me the most.
We mentioned the Confederations Cup a few times, Matt. You mentioned it just now. Was it kind of a bad thing that Löw didn't include any of his as many of his regulars last year than he may have should have, just as a kind of a cohesion thing? I know that there's these, I mean, Toni Kroos and Mesut Ozil and Thomas Müller are all players that had played a lot leading up to that tournament. So it made sense at the time last year that they weren't in the team. But we've talked about the cliques that have developed in the dressing room and how basically this team never reintegrated after that tournament. So Was that a kind of, speaking of assumptions, was that a kind of a miscalculation on the Dave Pace part?
Not necessarily the DFB's part, but certainly on Joachim Löw's part. I mean, at the end of the day, that's it's his job to blood that new generation and to get that balance right between the old guard's experience and the new players who are hungry to come in and prove a point. And I think, taken individually, in the short cameos that some of them had, that there was proof there that there would have been, in hindsight, a potential improvement. Julian Brandt's a couple of appearances off the bench. He became one of Germany's most effective players, and not just in the fact that he hit the post twice.
Should have started the career game ahead.
Should have started the career game. I'd agree with that. Sebastian Rudi's 25-minute cameo against Sweden.
Yeah, if he doesn't get injured.
I thought for those first 20 minutes when Germany... I mean, one of the reasons Germany were able to go forward so impressively and put Sweden under so much pressure in those opening 20 minutes was because Sebastian Rudi was doing a better job protecting the back four than Tony Kroos did in any of the other games. Or Sami Khedira. There's that as well. They were better when they played to Timo Werner's strengths more. He was wasted as a centre forward against Mexico because he's not a target man, and they brought Mario Gomez on far too late for that. Conversely, he was much more effective when he moved out to the left in the Sweden game, where he was able to use his pace and run at players. The introduction of Marco Reus was key. I think purely based on that, I think you can conclude that in hindsight, it probably would have been a better option to continue with that. But then you have to question, why didn't you do that? And it all comes back to the idea of these assumptions that the old proven players could just do it again at the flick of a switch. And John's already highlighted that arrogance and presumptuousness within the squad. I personally think it goes an awful lot deeper than just the training staff and just the team. I think it goes back, 6, 7, 8 months within the German FA. Mm. And we've seen that with various developments, whether it's this rechristening of the German national team as Die Mannschaft, which is absolutely laughable, whether it's the fan club Nationalmannschaft sponsored by Coca-Cola. I think, John, you put it really, really well in one of your videos that you sent back, and that it felt like this was Germany's exclusive party, which everyone else was lucky to be invited to. That was reflected in the choreographed press conferences, the over-elaborate introductions by the press manager, the over-elevation of every little utterance from Joachim Löw or any of the players to as if it was gospel passed down. This assumption, this idea that everyone else was lucky to be in the presence of Die Mannschaft. And I just think that ultimately was reflected in a pretty disgustingly crass way at the end of the Sweden game when the two German FA staff members celebrated with clenched fists in front of the Swedish bench. Not only is that in the short term extremely unsportsmanlike
unprofessional,
it's also endemic and representative of a deeper lying arrogance within the German FA. And I think that's the biggest shame in all that is that arrogance is traditionally an easy word to throw at German football and perhaps even German society over the past 50 years or so. Everyone had the impression that had gone from German football, especially since the rebuild, which started in 2004, 5, 6 and culminated in 2014. This was a new Germany which represented a new German country and a new German nation and a new German people and there was so much positive about the country, and it was representing that team. And one of the positives on it was that it was opening and friendly and sportsmanlike and not arrogant. It didn't smack of the likes of Oliver Kahn and Steffen Effenberg and the Mario Baslers of the past. The team who almost kicked France off the park in 82. There was none of that. This was a team that won fans across the world. And I think in the last 6 months, the German FA have... Yeah, I think they've clouded they've clouded that a little bit.
They've marketed it to death, and I think the point is that if you take Matt's right, if you take something successful and you oversell it, then you also give the people involved in that the wrong impression of what it is, and you put them under even further pressure.
Or you start to give them they start to believe their own press.
Yeah, and that's exactly what this Germany team did. They believed their own hype. They believed they were on an elevated status compared to other teams. That's certainly the impression that I got. How dare you say that you weren't prepared for the way that Mexico play? That's the opening game of the World Cup. You have all the facilities in the world at your disposal. You could watch every single game Mexico have ever played, trained, discussed, whatever, in the last 10 years. And you were surprised. You didn't have a reaction for them doubling up on Toni Kroos in midfield and leaving Sami Khedira alone. That is unacceptable. You're talking about the highest level of football. We're not talking about Sunday League and Dave didn't get to see how the other pub played last weekend. You're talking about Germany against Mexico in the opening game. And the fact that in that game, after that became apparent, there was no response from the players on the pitch. The best quality coaching leaves the utmost responsibility to the people on the pitch. That is what makes a great coach. It's not that you tell them what to do and they do it. It's that the players on the pitch already know what to do and they are the ones coaching. Where were the coaches on Germany's field in that game? No, nowhere.
Totally. It's sort of like Toni Kroos and Mats Hummels coming out, particularly after the Mexico game, and indirectly slagging off their own teammates. Well, they should have been making precisely those points about 45 minutes earlier.
In the game. You know, why is Joshua Kimmich playing as a right winger? Why are Mats and Jerome completely exposed every time the Mexico get the ball on the halfway line? It was a combination of miscommunication, tactical errors, and arrogance that, as Matt says, and as we've discussed, that all stems from this belief that Germany are built of something special. And I think in hindsight now, maybe this is another turning point for German football, that they can use this to go forward and start again. The question will be whether they can do that with Löw, but Löw's reputation is obviously in the balance now, which is perhaps a little unfair given everything that he's done.
Where does Löw go from here?
I mean, he has to rebuild and he has to make some very strong decisions because the squad has to change. I think the key players in this team... Okay, Mario Gomez is going to retire. He's 32. Khedira will retire. He's 32. Boateng tweeted after the tournament he was so depressed and pissed off that he's ready to come back. I was surprised. So he won't retire. Maybe Manuel Neuer will stay. Maybe he will go. You're talking about spinal changes in this team. Toni Kroos, I've read somewhere, that was considering it as well. So whatever changes and whatever leaves, Löw has to manage that. But bigger than that, Löw has to get away from this framework. He has to pick the best players. His in-game management wasn't very good. That was also a problem. He brought on Julian Brandt too late. He brought on Royce too late. He didn't react very well. But he has to stop thinking, these are the best players for me. And he has to start thinking, these are the best players to win the game. Because there were incidences where, you know, Brandt should have started. He should have made changes in the defensive area that weren't... Rudiger wasn't very good. He made uncharacteristic changes. He never normally makes that many changes. I mean, even five changes for the South Korea game, he never makes that many changes. And it was almost like a man who's desperate. You know, Matt Rose yesterday, he was trying desperately to cling on to something. And then it just slipped away from him. If he makes changes, he needs to be bold with them and not be sort of desperate or reactive. That was the impression I got. It was very, oh, I don't know what to do. Let's try this. That's what he needs to do in the future. He needs to make sure that this squad is stronger and has removed this level of arrogance. And he needs to remove that level of presumption. And I think a lot of that comes from a relationship with Oliver Bierhoff. He has to repair that.
Let's talk about Oliver Bierhoff too. Because
I'd get rid of him before I get rid of Löw.
I think one of the key things for me for Löw going forward is that I think he has to basically come back down to earth and come back down to basics slightly.
But that comes from the relationship with Bierhoff.
Oh, it does, we'll come on to that in a sec. But I thought there was a very... I just want to go into this slightly. There was a very telling interview that Joachim Löw gave to Kicker magazine just before the World Cup in which he described himself as a footballing visionary. A manager...
Not too impressed with that vision.
Well, yeah. Well, precisely. A manager who is now so experienced and has enjoyed so much success and deserves all the credit for that he enjoys spending the time that job affords him, travelling around the world, watching as much football as possible, studying the latest developments, identifying the trends which are going to shape the future of football. And the word he used was he sees himself as a bit of a footballing developer and visionary. Which makes me think that in that case, how didn't he see those tactics?
Blind visionary.
Well, yeah, which were used against Germany, and ironically, they were, I think, yeah, mainly Mexico, Sweden to an extent.
Well, South Korea did the same as
South Korea, especially in the second half. They were tactics which we actually see week in, week out in the Bundesliga. And there has been a trend at this World Cup
absorb,
possession based teams. struggling to break through. Spain is a perfect
example. 1,000 passes.
Exactly, and that was fine. But these are exactly the sort of cyclical footballing trends which Löw seems to think that he has identified and is an expert in. Spain dominated world football for 10 years with... which was an exhilarating brand of passing football and possession-based football. However, now I think we can clearly say we're in a new cycle of football now, where teams teams are more reactive. They play on the break. The key is those 3 or 4 seconds after winning the ball back in traditional football, and that's exactly what broke Germany down. And the irony is that football is what characterizes some of the best Bundesliga teams. It's how Red Bull did so well in their first season. It's how Jurgen Klopp does so well. I mean, he does the same with Liverpool. It's how Julian Nagelsmann plays. It's how Domenico Tedesco plays at times. And this is happening right under Joachim Löw's nose, right at home, in Germany. How's he not seeing this if he's keeping such a close eye on developments in football, because they were torn apart by what I think were actually very, very German tactics. I think he needs to come down to basics a little bit and get back to the coaching. He's proved he can do it. Like I said, he proved in the 2017 Confed Cup that he can still be hands-on, form a team, coach a team, manage a team properly. However, it seems, especially at the World Cup, and maybe, John, you can confirm it, there's such a massive coaching team set up around that team now, where Jürgen has delegated everything. Delegation is good. It's necessary at times, but has he perhaps got a little bit too hands-off?
The team behind the team is now, as I said in the video, it's an army now. It's a force to be.
Entourage.
It's ridiculous. And, you know, even one of the press conferences, there was an opportunity to hear that the guys from the analytics department from SAP that work with the national team to provide data. I mean, you're talking about, that's also slightly unnecessary because it's a branding opportunity. It's a publicity stunt. But it's also a case of how many people are involved in a match day. Because actually, is it too many now? You know, from a player's perspective, do you talk to Dave about your food, Steve about your stats, Mike about your data, your finishing you discuss with Steve? Like, what is it? You know, how many people do you have to talk to? And is that too many? Obviously, you want players to be well prepared and have everything that they need to be able to be successful. But then you get to the point that how much is too much? And it feels like the one thing that Germany kept talking about in 2014 that made them so strong was this team behind the team. And now they seem to have expanded upon that, thinking that a team behind a team behind a team behind a team would be a good idea. And now you've ended up with so many people that you don't know how to get the best out of it. And also that you lose some level of authority. I mean, Löw is obviously the head coach, but why is he not spotting these tactical issues, and why is he also not reacting to them, and why are the players not reacting to them? I mean, that's, as much as I am happy to criticize Löw for his mistakes, I also think we shouldn't forget that these players made some exceptionally poor decisions. I mean, you're talking about high quality players, and you're talking about World Cup winners, Champions League winners. We just got to the point now where some of these players are completely sated, that they have no desire anymore, because how are you going to tell Toni Kroos that he needs to keep playing because he's won so many Champions Leagues and a World Cup and titles? I mean, what's this guy got to play for anymore? Well, then you come back to the base level of, well, this is German football, this is Germany at a World Cup, this is a philosophy, that's what you're playing for. You're playing for the value, playing for the pride, playing for the way that we play the game. That wasn't apparent. 5 minutes into the South Korea game, I was like, they're going to lose. Sami Khedira looked like he never played football before. They couldn't pass. And when they passed, they just went, oh, there's nothing there, I'll pass it back.
In terms of the players themselves.
South Korea. And that's no disrespect, because there were South Koreans executed a brilliant game plan. But you cannot let a team that relies on one star player
that was already eliminated from the World Cup
to beat you in the way that they did.
In terms of the players themselves, I've had a comment questioning, I think quite rightly, but I'm interested to hear your opinion on it. Would Manuel Neuer have dared been on the edge of the South Korean box under Jupp Heynckes at Bayern?
That's a good question. I think there are... One thing I'd like to make clear, though, from my perspective, and this is obviously just my opinion, I do not think that Germany lost this based on selection. I think that Löw picked absolutely good enough players. The quality of every single position was fine. I thought Manuel Neuer was another player that we didn't mention earlier that actually was probably one of Germany's best players. His save against Sweden was amazing. He was very comfortable in the Mexico game. And the fact that he lost the ball on the edge of the box or even made that attempt just shows how desperate he was. I thought Neuer was actually a leader in a way that other players weren't. He was trying very hard. The problem is that there's a disconnect because he's in his goal. Even if he strays forward as he does and roams and sweeps, he's still not in the game. And that's why that sort of vocal, you know, grab the shirt, come on guys, where are we, doesn't translate because he's in goal. So that was almost quite a poetic moment. He was kind of like, no, if you're not going to do it, I'm going to do it. I'm trying to take control of the situation. Of course he's going to lose the ball. He's a goalkeeper who never plays outfield. If he'd have done it in Jupanka's team, he never needed to do it in Jupanka's team. That's maybe the bigger issue because Bayern were never really in that situation where Manuel Neuer needed to come forward and cross the ball. I was frustrated about, and I say this thing about selection and Neuer because there were some conversations about him being, you know, a strange pick. And I said that before the tournament. I said Ter Stegen should have started. I'm happy to say now, on the basis of the way Germany played, Neuer was not the issue.
Well, let's
neither was Sané, because if that conversation ever comes up again, I'm gonna.
But let's go back to the dressing room though, because
yep.
Matt mentioned this before, and I think you can speak to the best of anybody in the studio right now. What was the split in Germany's team? Was it Confederations Cup players?
It felt more like, I mean, the reports from other colleagues who were there, that mostly from Bild, suggest that there was this, quote, bling-bling group with Jerome Boateng.
Bling versus Bayern,
yeah,
I think, wasn't
and,
it?
And yeah, there's a sort of a clash of cultures there. I can't say that I saw any of that in training. The divisions that I saw were on the pitch and they were positional. There's obviously some division in the team character wise.
Was evident to you?
Toni Kroos is a very, I think Rafa Honigstein wrote a very good piece about it. He's a very lone wolf. And the photo after the South Korea game where he's on his own in the middle of the pitch and the South Korean fans team is celebrating. He's always been a guy who's been about himself and what he can bring to the team. He doesn't really care, I don't think, about forming those relationships or what that's all about. If you manage it correctly.
Well, which is also why, I mean, many still question why Bayern Munich sold Kroos back in the day.
That's a whole other conversation. But
true. Yeah.
I think Kroos, but if you know how to manage that situation, then it doesn't become uncontrollable. You know, if you have a group of players who are young and identify with a different, I don't know, way of life, or, you know, a little bit more relaxed and maybe more interested in personal progression, then you need to manage that as a coach. And then we come back to Yulev not recognizing that and not seizing control. And if he has delegated, why haven't the coaches in his staff who are exposed on a day-to-day basis, your Marcus Sorgs, your Miroslav Klauses, why have they not then relayed that information and seen that? Because as a coach, you're also going to notice the way that people react and interact with one another. And if there are divisions in the team, then you need to solve that very, very swiftly. And Germany obviously didn't do that. And I think the clearest example of division was on the pitch and the way that they just didn't communicate. There wasn't any response. I mean, how does Joshua Kimmich go from his best season in his career to the worst three games of his
life?
Positionally, tactically, it doesn't make any sense. You know, there are a lot of question marks about what really went on in the change rooms, what conversations were had, who disagreed with who, and why Löw wasn't able to control that situation. I mean, come full circle, what we were talking about 10-15 minutes ago, Oliver Bierhoff has a lot of responsibility to take, I think, and in the same respect that I think we shouldn't just forget the players and talk about only Löw making mistakes, I think Oliver Bierhoff's position has to be questioned. This is a guy who is in a Caesar-like role in terms of power. He has gone all in on the development of this academy in Frankfurt. He is very, very keen to be... He's going to lead a team of, I think, 100 people when he takes over that role. The guy is selling this Germany team every single day.
He
and
is.
Selling the greatness of this Germany team.
Matt, we were watching some of the press conferences together, and it was literally like a marketing director.
His language, even in Suterol, in the training camp, his language is, and you got to give him credit, he's very good at it, and that's why he is where he is. But I want to know, and I don't think we'll ever find out, what that feels like for Joachim Löw. Because I think there's a strong disconnect. And there was a report, I think it was Martin Ziegler, I'm not sure, about the fact that Löw wanted to be in Sochi because he wanted to latch onto that COD Fed Cup feeling. And the DFB said no because of financial restraints. And we come back to the things that Matt mentioned earlier. They've backed themselves into a corner because they can't afford it. That obviously must have pissed off Löw, because I can tell you from personal experience, Vatu Tinki was terrible. You're talking about somewhere that is an hour.
Apologies
and a half.
To any listeners from Vatu Tinki.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Can you give us 30 seconds?
So
on
an hour and a half outside of Moscow, you're talking about the German national team hotel being, it's fine, it's a big building, you know, it's a 4-star hotel with decent facilities, but it's exposed. It's in the middle of nowhere. It's a 20-minute journey to CSKA Moscow's training pitch, which is, for a top-level team in Russia, probably pretty good, but it was like going to Unterhaching's training. Okay, so it's just not really phenomenal. And Joachim Löw complained that the grass was a few millimeters too high, and that's why Julian Draxler bruised his ankle after training. So you're talking about a team that is very precious.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's just the level of ridiculousness, right? But those are the kind of facilities that Germany are working into, and that's another level of arrogance. You're saying that you're beyond this, you're above this kind of football that we've all played. Because you're a Weltmeister. Give me a break. If you can't play here, then you can't play there when it matters. And that was the case. It was such a removed and closed off and middle of nowhere place. And the logistics of moving around, it was clear that Bierhoff thought that they were going to be around in the tournament for longer and that Moscow would have been a better base. But for Teamgeist, in this sense in German, which is this team unity, it didn't do them any wonders. I mean, what is it Toni Kroos said in his first press conference? He can't wait to go on holiday.
Mm-hmm.
Great. I bet you're loving life if you're over there.
Joachim Löw described the facilities
as a
good sports school.
Yeah, and yeah. That in itself is also an admission.
And you could tell the difference in the amount of fun and comfort that Joachim Löw was enjoying when he got down to Sochi, which obviously a nice weather beach resort on the coast of the Black Sea, and he was enjoying his morning jogs and posing by lamppost.
Also, you have to think also back to Brazil and the facilities that they had.
Yeah,
there.
I mean, they talk about Campo Bahia and they talk about how great that was, but obviously if they don't win, then that's not an issue. Obviously, it makes a big difference to the atmosphere of the team. And as much as they weren't necessarily amazing against Sweden, let's not forget that they won that game and that in their very brief World Cup spell, the best football that they played was in that game.
After being in Sochi. Yeah.
In a stadium that a lot of those players, Rudy, Prant, Werner, had played in before at the Confed Cup in circumstances they knew, and they should have used that experience to their advantage.
And you're talking about logistically, they stayed in the Radisson Blue, right? That is a 2-kilometer, 3-kilometer walk from the stadium, right? It's on the seafront. Which means that the players were then exposed to their fans. They were able to relax. The training ground was a 5-minute drive. The stadium was a 7-minute drive. Everything is very close and accessible. You are close to people. You aren't worrying about anything else. You're just worried about the football. And it's no surprise to me that Germany's best football and their best result came in that spell of 5 days.
I think the logistics are important. There was also, I think, was it the first press conference when they arrived in Vatu Tinki was actually delayed by 2 hours or 2.5 hours because Reinhard Grindel, the president of the FA, had been at the FIFA Congress awarding the 2026 World Cup, hadn't he?
To
US, Mexico, Canada, which had taken place in the centre of Moscow with FIFA. But he had insisted that he be present at this first DFB Demandschaft press conference in Russia, but they underestimated the Moscow traffic. But by all accounts, talking about 2 hours, 2.5 minutes, two and a half hours to get from the centre of Moscow, just a 1.5 hour drive out. But yeah, if anyone knows the logistics of traffic in Moscow, that's probably not too surprising. But the fact that they even had to wait for the presence of the head of the German FA to be there when you should be preparing
for a
football tournament.
Yeah, and that. And it's funny, when Germany lost that opening game to Mexico and the next, before they flew to Sochi, the press conference, before we all flew as journalists and before the team flew, Manuel Neuer was an hour late to the press conference. And he said when he arrived, "Oh, I'm sorry that we're so late. We had a team meeting that went on for a long time and we discussed the importance of the issues of the first game." And he said in that meeting, he said in that press conference that in the meeting, young players had spoken up, people had said what their opinion there of, and it had come together, that people had clashed, that it had been quite vocal. And everybody, all the reporters there were like, right, so Germany have understood now. This team has come together and understood what this means and that they can't perform and the team is going to come together and beat Sweden. They beat Sweden. Everybody's thinking, here we go, Germany have arrived. And then actually, it was a faux arrival because everything that they'd said before hadn't really registered, it seemed. But the hour-long wait, as much as I understand that a team meeting takes precedence, that is also inexcusable. You know, you're saying to the press that the time of the press conference is 12:30. Well, is it 12:30 or is it 1:30?
And I appreciate the point that you're lucky to be invited as guests to the DFB party in Russia, and that's the impression
that it
gets.
Same point, you know. Yeah, absolutely, the press are there to report on the team, but. And the team's meetings and the team takes precedence. This isn't about the media, but you're talking about just rude, basically, on a really base level. If you know that you're going to have a team meeting and you know it's really important and you know that the chances are it's going to run long and that you know you have to take a journey to get to the press conference and then you're going to fly to Sochi later, don't make it an hour, you know. And I can understand that these things sometimes happen. There's traffic and da-da-da, but... I think a lot of people felt at that point that it's just the DFB don't really care.
All right, so we've talked about Germany a lot, about what happened. Now I think it's important that we look a little bit forward because the next major tournament is the Euro 2020, where one game will also be in Munich. What are Germany's expectations now?
Got to win it.
Yeah, the expectation is to win it. And I must have, I actually think circumstances have come together quite well for Germany and Jürgen Löw looking at this.
Yeah.
Does Löw have to win this?
Yes.
Not necessarily have to. It'll depend on performances. Yeah, of course, that'll be the aim. And but I don't think a semi-final exit or a final defeat is going to tarnish Joachim Löw's legacy.
I don't think it'll tarnish the legacy.
It depends on performances.
I don't think it'll tarnish the legacy. I agree with that. But I think he's under more pressure now than he has ever been before, and that's why, certainly.
But there are certain advantages to it as well, and I mentioned this in the piece yesterday. Yeah. It'll help that they've got, as I understand it, at least one home game in Munich, potentially more, because Munich is a host city. Obviously, let's not forget
that matters, because home fans don't really generate any.
Well,
atmosphere.
True, but who knows? Look at the boost that Russia have had, and I'm assuming the boost is from the fans and not from anything else. But
yeah, but those fans turned up.
Yeah.
When was the last time you heard Germany fans?
That might be a boost. Well, 2006 when they hosted it.
How long ago is that? Yeah. Obvious. There you go.
Well, who knows? That might be a factor. I think another positive factor is actually the Nations League starts in September.
That's true too.
Germany have, I think, France and Holland home and away before the end of this year. These are, I'd say, not even semi-competitive, competitive games, which is replacing friendlies. Against good teams, be a potential World Cup winner in France, and a Holland team. Well, we'll see how much they've developed. But when that comes to it, but yeah, that'll be positive for Germany. And this is the perfect opportunity now for Löw to start his rebuild straight away.
I don't think he has the time anymore, though. That's my only concern.
I think that's arguably a good thing.
No, absolutely. Maybe he has to. You know, he's going to up his ante. But my issue is if he doesn't win this tournament, I think Germany have had enough of semi-finals. And so at that point, it's win or goodbye.
I think it'll be his last tournament either way. I think it's important that the German FA start planning for a successor right now.
Yes.
With the eventuality that whatever happens in 2020, that would probably be the end of the road for Löw. As far as he's concerned, hopefully on a high, whether that means winning it or at least going out with his head held high, that he's started a rebuild. You know, he's got 2 years to reintegrate new players. He's already said that Leroy Sané will definitely be in the team come September, and that's not to say, you know, that's not to say that Leroy Sané would have made a difference in Russia. I agree with John. I don't think that's the be-all and end-all. I think his replacement, Julian Brandt, showed exactly why he was in the team and made exactly the difference that he was expected to make. So I don't think we can rest it on that. But yeah, we can definitely hold up Sané as an example, as a young player who can come in and become a key part of this team going forward. And I think it'll be a positive that he's got a series of competitive games, particularly boosted by this Nations League, in the build-up to a tournament which will be partly hosted in Germany. And I think, yeah, that basically means that circumstances have actually worked out relatively favourable for Germany looking ahead for the next 2 years.
Yeah, I think the Nations League is somewhat interesting because it's kind of the level at the Confederations Cup. If you win it, nobody remembers, and if you lose it, nobody remembers. So I mean, nobody's gonna. I mean, I don't think in 50 years we're not gonna say we're not gonna remember who won the first Nations League. I don't think, but. It is their competitive games.
Who knows? I think it's key that it's competitive, and also football's becoming so, for bad or worse, so all-inclusive in so many areas of life, and also so globalised that there is a constant demand from all over the globe for the constant football, and that's not satiated by meaningless friendlies.
Even
personally, as a football fan and a football journalist, I cannot stand international friendlies. Yeah. They do my head in. In fact, I look forward to them. I can have a week off. It's not football, so I'm glad to see the back of them, or at least some of them. I think this Nations League will be quite good. It provides a more long-term aim, long-term competitiveness, and a slightly bigger boost and a bigger stage to actually develop a proper team spirit.
All right, so I want to kind of toot our horn here because I think, unlike a lot of podcasts, we have two people that were actually in Russia for this World Cup, and I want to take advantage of that. So can each of you share maybe your favorite anecdote? Of course, Matt, you were extreme. Everybody knows why John was there, but Matt, you were there for the England-Belgium game in Kaliningrad, the closest flight from Germany that you could probably get. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people that are listening to this, including myself, I'll listen to it later, are curious as to basically what it was like for you guys to be in Russia for the World Cup. So share your favorite anecdote.
Favorite anecdote was probably right at the start when we boarded our flight to Vilnius in Lithuania at halftime. All good stories start in Vilnius, obviously. at halftime in this Germany-South Korea game at 0-0. So we had no idea
you were in the air
of what was going on until at 30,000 feet somewhere over Poland, I assume, the Portuguese air steward comes on the speaker and says, "Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, just a quick update for the football fans." And the plane was obviously full of about, I'd say, a dozen England fans, maybe 25 or so Belgium fans. Obviously, Cologne's not far from Belgium either. And obviously a lot of German passengers too. And everyone went silent, like, "Oh, what's happened?" And he goes, "I'm sorry to say that Germany have lost," with a bit of a smirk. And obviously the England fans went up, the Belgian fans went up, the German fans weren't happy. So we found out in mid-air, obviously, but not knowing how it had happened. We just knew the score and that Germany were out. But we had no idea that Neuer had given the ball away on the edge of the box, that there had been two last-minute goals, that Sami Khedira had given the ball away after 30 seconds.
Or that we had
absolutely no idea of any of this. Until, obviously, we arrived in Vilnius and then proceeded by train, which had come from Moscow via Minsk to Vilnius to pick us up, and then onto the Russian exclave, which is Kaliningrad. Exclave? Enclave? I'm not particularly sure of the geographical term of that.
Yeah.
It's a bit of Russia that's separate. The Russian Navy base, I believe. Obviously, we got on that train, and yeah, that's Russian trains are an experience, and I would recommend them to absolutely anybody who gets a chance. It is, you come into contact with completely normal people making their way from across Eastern Europe, from Moscow to Kaliningrad. You have to somehow find a way to communicate with them, but they're all extremely friendly. I was surprised at the amount of German which was understood, if not quite spoken, but understood by people from Kaliningrad, more so than English. So we had a lot of sort of four-way translations going on, but very friendly people. One thing which we didn't know, And this is actually, if I may add one little anecdote from the way back after the game. Trains in Russia, or at least in Western Russia, all the train times are Moscow time. So regardless of your time zone, and Kaliningrad is an hour behind Moscow, an hour ahead of the UK, same time as Germany, all train times are Moscow time. So despite our train back on the ticket leaving at, I think, 8 minutes past two, it actually left at 8 minutes past one in Kaliningrad, which obviously gives ample room for major cock-ups at the station. We luckily knew, we were aware of this, and it wasn't a problem for us. However, when we got to the border between Kaliningrad and Lithuania, obviously that's where you re-enter the EU, so there's huge passport checks, the Russians check, then the Lithuanians check. We ended up sat in the restaurant carriage having a beer with a couple of lads from Belarus who were on their way back to Minsk, and they'd been to the game in Kaliningrad. These two, they speak Russian. They're from that part of the world. You'd think they understand. No, they didn't. They'd got to the train station 40 minutes late, thinking they were 20 minutes early. Train had gone, and they'd proceeded to get in a taxi in Kaliningrad to the Russian border, or to the Lithuanian border. Cost them about 80 euros, 100 euros or something. Proceeded to cross the border on foot, and then caught up with the train and got on there. So they just made it. I think the next.
Did they go through passport control?
But on foot. Whereas we'd passed. We'd done it on the train, obviously, amazing. and the police get on great and they check everyone's passports.
That'd be hilarious if football fans had to smuggle themselves back.
Yeah, well, that's effectively what they had to try and do. They got in a taxi and drove there. So yeah, lucky to those lads. And if they're, I doubt they're listening, but I hope they got back to Minsk. Okay.
Great.
John, what was your favorite anecdote?
Oh, it's tough to top a train from Vilnius.
Well, you went to the Iceland game. You went to lot of other games, too.
I was lucky to see a few different places in Russia. And I think a couple of things that sort of spring to mind. The language is definitely a stumbling block. I don't think I was necessarily as prepared as I'd have liked to have been for how little language anybody speaks other than Russian.
You left your Russian-English dictionary at home?
I mean, I've made some notes on the language, but it's just so difficult. Also, to read it is almost impossible. It's that great Ian Rush quote, it's like being in a foreign country. it was really strange. And I think there was a sort of a small percentage of what people say it's like to be in China is what it's like to be there, because to an extent you really are an alien at that point. There's no helping you. But that made it sort of more enjoyable, I have to say. People were very friendly. I spoke to a couple of people who said that they hope that when the party is over, that the positivity stays in Russia. I think that's obviously the big concern. It's easy for a young white man to go to Russia and say how great it is, but there are a lot of question marks about what really goes on there and how the truth is maybe not being portrayed in these 4 weeks.
Did it feel superficial at all?
There were definitely times. There was one image.
You think that too, Matt?
I think.
Yeah, slightly. In two ways. I think in the areas around the stadiums and the official fan fests that they set up in each city.
Yeah.
I described it as FIFA land. You really could be anywhere in the world. It's completely irrelevant. The fact that you're in Russia is completely irrelevant there. It's FIFA world. And there everything is completely, it's like Disneyland. And the other one is this image that the Russian government and the Russian state are consciously
presenting
to the world for a month, which we all know that they're doing that. And I think the majority of visitors can see past the facade. On the one hand, you have to enjoy it for what it is. The Russians themselves seem to be enjoying for the first time coming into contact with a lot of strangers, not just in Moscow, which is a tourist attraction, of course, but in places like Kaliningrad and Nizhny Novgorod, Yekaterinburg. These aren't tourist cities, and for a lot of people, they're coming to their first contact with strangers, and it's not just the Russians who maybe we think perhaps slightly incorrectly who have been fed with a false impression of Western visitors, but perhaps also we've been fed with a slightly false impression of the Russian people as well.
That certainly seemed to be apparent to me when I was lucky to sort of see different places. There was one image that I would sort of, you're talking about superficiality, when I left one of the stadiums, I think it was after, yeah, it was after the Argentina-Iceland game. You're surrounded by volunteers who are giving you, in my opinion, propaganda. Thank you for coming to Russia. We love you. Have a great day. You're wonderful. High five.
But we had this in the build, though. I was there in October when United played CSKA Moscow, and I think Arsenal fans had it too when they played also CSKA, I think, wasn't it, in the Europa League. And you're presented, there are volunteers at the stadium presenting you with gifts. In our case, it was hats or ponchos or something, saying friendly Russian welcome to the English fans, to give this impression.
Wow. So you have that. Mm. And then behind, so they line you, basically, or direct you to the metro. And 5 meters behind them are soldiers. So I wasn't able to take a photo for obvious reasons, but it was definitely the image of the World Cup for me, because you're faced with people who are young people who are friendly, who have studied English, who have a basic grasp of the language, but who are really happy to have you here and probably are genuinely very happy to be exposed to so many cultures. It was one thing that someone who's lived in Moscow, who was from the Urals, told me, that they had never experienced something like this in Russia before, where so many cultures had suddenly been exposed to the Russian people. And you've got that in the embodiment of these volunteers. And then right behind them are these soldiers, very earnest looking. And I asked someone, and they said, those are not ordinary soldiers. Those are next level soldiers.
Okay, wow.
So it's a very strange feeling. Because on the one hand, you've got this is what we want you to think, but don't step out of line.
Mm.
And that for me was a very strong image for the tournament itself. I was lucky to go to Kazan and to Sochi. Sochi was, I'm sure a lot of people have been there for the Winter Olympics and generally, but it felt like Spain and not necessarily the best parts. It was a tourist promenade. Everything felt very anglicized in some respects. There's a huge theme park there. Everything was very exposed in terms of sort of bright lights and all going on. I will say that from someone coming from Batutinki at the time, this was a hugely welcome change. Civilization was welcome.
There's only so much authentic post-industrial Russian culture that John Harding can take.
Only so many mornings that I can take outside my hotel, walking past horses eating grass in the field, before I wonder whether tumbleweed is going to knock me over again or not. And Sochi was a very welcome change in that respect, because the food was different. There were lots more people. Wow, people. That was nice. And so in that respect, it was great. Kazan was probably the hidden beauty of the trip, though. It was really, really pretty place. Yeah. And it was only an hour flight from Moscow. Really wonderful. Hidden away. And had something to offer. Sadly, we were only there for a very small moment. A historic one, nonetheless, but a brief moment in time. But throughout the trip, the feeling definitely was that the people that I met who were from Russia were just overwhelmed at what the exposure to culture means to them. Mm. I think that sort of stayed with me. When we were in Moscow, the day before I flew back, there was a huge party in Moscow, and I can't remember, one of the games had just finished, and
hopefully because you forgot, not because
everybody was no, it was just I got lost, and I missed a boat trip with the people that I was with, my colleagues, so I ended up meeting another friend of mine who was also working at the tournament, and we ended up sitting outside on the corner of one of Moscow's main squares at sort of 1 a.m. And there were 2,000 or 3,000 people there going crazy, you know, having a party, dancing, singing, talking. And we got chatting to this couple from Moscow who had known each other and been here for a really long time. And they said to us, I've never seen Moscow like this. And Moscow is a tourist city. So you can only wonder what it's like.
Well, the centre, at least.
Yeah, you can only wonder what it's like in other cities. But for someone who's lived in Moscow their whole life to say they'd never seen it like this. And you're talking about an overwhelmingly positive feeling I mean, obviously, we've talked about the fact that a lot of this isn't necessarily a true reflection of Russia, but I think most importantly, to the people who live there, I was happy for them to experience, you know, exposure to 10,000 Peruvians, 15,000 Mexicans going absolutely off their trolley because they'd beaten Germany. What it was like to meet and greet and understand people who speak a different language. I saw someone talking to someone else through Google Translate.
Oh, I was wondering about that.
We had a lot of that, yeah.
Taxi drivers.
Using Google Translate. Yeah.
Same thing. You know, I thought I was nearly died in a taxi on the way back from the airport when we first arrived. The guy drove on the side of the motorway where the motorway stops being road and starts being gravel. And like, it just went in the bus lane, went in the side, and there was a huge crack across his windscreen. And I just happened to be sat in the front. Really needed to change my trousers after that trip, but unbelievable, you know. And these guys, they just and he got us to where we wanted to be like 10 minutes before we should have been there. And you know, I said to him, you know, through the Russian translator that we had, not Google Translate or translator, one of our friends spoke Russian, and we found out the old-fashioned, an actual person. We found out that the guy had taken an extreme driving course and was able to do like extreme maneuvers. And I was like, did you do any of them just now? And he was like, no, that's just the start. I was like, I'm getting out now. Thank you for the journey. I'm never getting in a cab with you again. Super friendly, but honestly, if you you know, want to test the level of your white knuckles, then take a cab journey.
The integrity of your underwear.
Yeah, the big takeaway, I think, really, and John mentioned it there, the amount of South Americans who made the trip.
Unbelievable.
Tens upon tens of thousands from Argentina, Mexico, Colombia, Peru were brilliant.
Amazing fans. And what are you going to... It must be a trip of a lifetime. They must have come for 2 or 3 weeks. That's halfway across the world.
Yeah, they must.
However, England fans have been conspicuous by their absence so far. Yeah. Germany as well.
Wow.
And I think a lot of that is down to... I think it's down to some of the reporting in the British press. So just to sort of bring it onto England slightly, obviously there is extenuating political circumstances in the wake of the Skripal affair and the poisoning. However, there has been quite an anti-Russian sentiment in the British press going into it, and a lot of it is for good reason, as we said. And we know that the Russia which has been presented to us is the Russia that they want to present to the world for 4 weeks. However, it's had this sad effect that less than 2,000 England fans travelled to Volgograd for the first game. And you're talking about a country which prides itself on having one of the best and biggest, most fanatical supports, despite winning nothing.
We're crazy.
Forever. And less than 2,000 went. Is that there weren't many in at the next game in Nizhny Novgorod either. There were slightly more in Kaliningrad because it was easier to get to slightly via Poland or Lithuania. And only now... going into the quarterfinals now, I think, is this excitement building in and almost regret building among a lot of usual match-going fans in the UK who probably wished they'd gone out there. But I think they genuinely had been scared off by reports of hooliganism and political problems. And I think, although, of course, that existed. What happened in Marseille and the Euros happened. We can't deny that, and there was a reason behind it, and it was terrible. I think there's been a lot of lazy reporting and lazy journalism at home. I think there was never any danger of hooliganism at this World Cup. Not for positive reasons, but for the negative reason that they all know the politicians and the police know them, and they've been cracked down on, and they've said no, you will not cause trouble on home soil during our World Cup.
And every single fan has a fan ID.
Yeah.
You have to wear it. So everybody who works in that, everybody knows exactly who you are, what your photo is, what your ID number is, and they need to background check you.
But some of the reporting at home seems to have taken none of this into account, seems to have had very, very little understanding of Russian football culture, Russian fan culture, Russian hooligan culture. I'm not saying I do. I'm not an expert either, but I took the time to try and inform myself a little bit and learnt that it would be next to impossible for Russian hooligans to cause a problem with foreign fans at the World Cup because the police have cracked down on them so much.
Don't want to portray that image.
Exactly. It's also, from what I understand, the sort of fans who tend to attend World Cups, they're not a target for Russian hooligans anyway. They act with a very macho and almost fascist mentality. They don't want to be attacking families in fancy dress. That doesn't boost their manliness or macho-ness enough. So I think it's a shame, and I think it's definitely been the case in England, and I think a lot of people have probably missed out, which is unfortunate because England have a fantastic travelling support.
Speaking of hooliganism, I want you guys to bring your inner hooliganism out. And
where's this going?
Considering the fact that yesterday was one of the most important turning points in English football history.
I don't think we acted as hooligans yesterday, Matt. I don't think we were hooligans.
A couple of chairs got thrown, but yeah. Nothing big.
Do you guys want to each talk about...
Smashed a couple of desks up.
Just a couple minutes and let your inner English hooliganism out for a couple of minutes?
It's exciting.
It's an exciting time to be an England fan again.
I'm really chuffed that they came through. What I was saying to you before, David, before we came on air, it's a very young team. They've gone in there with relatively little expectations and a good feeling around it. It's just a case of get some experience at the World Cup, get as far as you can. It's all about team building ahead of future competitions under a young manager with a young team, so that's all good. And I thought, 93 minutes in, if this young team can survive this for just 1 minute, 30 seconds more, this will be a huge feather in the cap to have come through a game like that against a team like that. And I thought Colombia disgraced themselves slightly.
Niggly,
which is a shame. It's a shame for them because we know they can play football. There's some outstanding footballers and great quality. And I thought they resorted to tactics and mental mind games that they didn't need to. And I thought England stood up to it really, really well for the large part. And I thought if they can overcome this, that'd be a huge boost, huge learning curve, a huge great experience to overcome an opposition like that. And they didn't. I thought, oh, well, they've fallen just short.
Same old England.
They've fallen just short. But they came back.
Yeah.
And that shows fantastic team spirit, fantastic courage. Doesn't mean that England are now going to march on and win the World Cup. But
it doesn't matter if they don't, though.
It's a great learning curve for them.
That's the thing for me. I'm sure Matt feels the same. It's the first time in a long time that we've watched an England team where they're genuinely likeable, from the manager to the players, and that we feel a certain sense of connectivity to them. They overcame a really difficult game, overcame a challenge, and in a way that they've never done before in my life. I can't remember an England team overcoming. Normally, we get a player sent off in that game, and we lose. We concede in the last minute, and then they score two in extra time, or we lose on penalties. This England team didn't let that happen to them. Yeah, they were a little bit poor in the first half of extra time, but then they came roaring back in the second, could have won it then, and then won it on penalties. And that's something I think a lot of England fans will probably feel very, very encouraged by, whatever happens. Whether we beat Sweden or not, probably be pretty ironic we'll lose to them on penalties, right? But it doesn't matter, because actually what we've seen now are the first beginnings of a team that looked like they could actually win something. And you know, it's just an incredible, incredible feeling.
That's positive from a mental point of view. But I think tactically going ahead, they do need to be a bit more clinical in front of goal. I think someone tried to dampen the party last night, didn't they, by saying, "Oh, by the way, England have only scored one goal from open play," and someone told them to do one pretty quickly. But it is true. I think against Sweden, it's not going to be like playing.
Defenders.
Yeah, it'll be they're up against a well-stocked defence, and they're going to have to take chances which come to them. We saw how profligate England were against Tunisia at times, wasting chances. Rashford missed a big chance against Belgium as well. There were chances missed against Colombia as well. Yeah. So they're going to have to take them, because I don't think there'll be that many chances in it, because Sweden can defend really well.
Is football coming home?
No, if we beat Sweden and we're in the final four, we'll be playing in Croatia by all likeliness, right? So at that point, you'd have to say Croatia are a better team. But I think the key to this team, and the key to the way that the fans have been, it's going to be hard to stop England fans now believing that they're not going to win this. But the key to the England team is that they have always taken this one game at a time. I mean, Gareth Southgate, he was annoyed at the suggestion in the media that England deliberately lost the Belgium game to go to the weaker side of the draw. He said, "We want to win games. I'm annoyed at that suggestion. I rotated because I thought that was the best option for the team." If he continues the way that he is as a coach and the team continues to take it one game at a time, that's what I'm happy to do. You know, you don't want to sound like a player at a press conference, but is it coming home? it's hard to not be excited or think that because we've won on penalties, something special can happen. But I retain the same sense that whatever happens, this is a New England team, and that's exciting.
Is football coming home, Matt?
No, I totally agree with John. I don't think England have to win this. It's, yeah, it's a great opportunity, obviously. Be great if they did. But I mean, yeah, the likelihood of Croatia in the semis, if they got that far, is an extremely tough challenge. And then the likelihood of a potentially France or Brazil or something in the final. Yeah, there's no point looking that far
ahead.
If it's
France, Ali Farhat, Sophie Sabini, if you're listening, we're coming.
All right, that's enough for now. We'll be back soon to talk more about the World Cup and slowly get into more Bundesliga topics. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. You can also like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter at Tribuna Podcast. Matt Ford is on Twitter at Matt_4D, Jonathan Harding at JohnBlog66, 2 G's and 2 6's, and I'm at Davis_VanOppler. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon.